Hello, welcome to the Rest is History special bonus episode. And Dominic, this is the first ever episode that we have recorded in the Southern Hemisphere.
It is. We're speaking to you from the shores of Lake Rotorua in the North Island of New Zealand, where we've been spending the last few days, haven't we, Tom? So we flew into Kuala Lumpur, capital of Malaysia, which for a historian is a slightly underwhelming place.
Slightly.
Because we went to the oldest mosque, which was built by a man called Arthur, wasn't it? I can't remember his surname. He was English, and it was 1909, I think, something like that. 8, 9.
Well, because I wanted to go and see the cricket pitch, which apparently stood right at the heart of the colonial Kuala Lumpur. And it was all a bit soggy and despondent, wasn't it? Because we got there and it was a field and it was absolutely pissing down with rain. It was very grey and it was all a bit of a disappointment.
It was.
But we liked the two enormous phallic towers.
The Petronas Towers.
The Petronas Towers.
Yep. So we went up to the Petronas Towers. Then we went on to New Zealand, where we've been amazed, not amazed. We've been as impressed as we expected to be by the amazing landscapes, I think. And the warmth of the people, of course, very keen on the rest of his history in New Zealand, which is always a good sign, always a good recommendation for a country. And we went to somewhere we've talked about on the podcast, which is Hobbiton.
Yes.
Which was splendid. I greatly enjoyed going to Hobbiton, didn't you, Tom?
Very much. And then today we've been up in a helicopter. We've flown over a kind of a volcano, kind of Mount Doom-esque other volcano in the distance. Then we walked on a river to some very Rivendell-esque waterfalls, and it's been a lovely day.
We just got
back. And we're now in a spectacular Airbnb, which is the kind of thing which in a Scandinavian drama, there'd be a murder, but nothing really would happen. Detectives would come and there'd be kind of metaphysical discussions.
So we're not the Rest is Holidays. We're the Rest is History. I'm well aware of that. And so, Tom, I want to ask you the first of several questions that we have about the first episodes of the Aztecs series.
Which are still rolling out, aren't they? I mean, lots of members will have listened to all of them, I guess.
This is for you. The first question is for you. It's from Mary O'Neill. She says, hello, I thoroughly enjoyed Camilla Townsend's fascinating book on the Aztecs. As the Aztecs were yet another ancient culture to employ slaves in the building of the empire, you got me, Mary O'Neill, wondering if there were any ancient civilizations that did not enslave people. She came across some references to the Inca, who apparently didn't enslave people, but also didn't have a typical market economy. She was wondering what you knew about this.
What do you know about the Incas and slavery?
I don't know very much. I thought the Incas probably did have slaves, actually, but I might be wrong. Are there ancient peoples that definitely don't? So that of the ancient peoples you've written about and that you're interested in, your Babylonians, your Romans, your Persians, your Greeks, they all have slaves, don't they?
So my memory of the Incas is that there is a group of people called Yanacona, and there's a debate about whether they are slaves or not.
Mm-hmm.
So as I remember, they are prisoners of war, but there's something to do with the functioning of the Incan economy. I can't remember. It was a kind of quite a famous debate.
Right.
But essentially, in a pre-industrial society, you need labor to build things. So how you do that, I mean, the options are kind of chattel slavery of the kind that the Greeks had, the Romans had, the Arabs had, or you can have a caste system like they have in India, where people are born into subordinate or subservient states, or you have a wage economy. But essentially, you need to find ways to get people to do jobs that most people don't want to do. And slavery is a kind of obvious way of solving that.
I mean, it's an extraordinary statistic, isn't it, that at the time of the Norman conquest, an enormous proportion of English society consisted of what they called them churls. The Vikings called them thralls. And they're not quite slaves, but pretty slave adjacent, aren't they?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And then the Normans come, and it's part of what the Normans bring is the abolition of that.
Yeah.
I think kind of institutionalized oppression of entire classes of people is pretty much a given in all pre-industrial societies, and I suppose Marxists would argue in all societies, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay, so this is Norton. I understand why gold is so valuable for the Spaniards, but do the Aztecs understand its value? In other words, do Aztecs see gold as being the ultimate in the way that the Spanish do?
No, the answer is no. So the Aztecs, like all such peoples, they do value gold because they think it's pretty. Effectively, it's beautiful, it's decorative, and it's highly prized. you know, you can make lovely ornaments and trinkets out of it. And of course, it, the fascination of gold is that it catches the light in a way nothing else does. But the Aztecs don't have a currency. So we know from the market, the great market at Tlatelolco, which is the kind of suburb of Mexico, well, of Tenochtitlan. I mean, it's in now in the just north of the downtown in Mexico City, I think it is. We know from that market that people would go and they would say, oh, I like this lovely thing. The cost is 4 blankets. The cost is 10 beans, whatever. So it's effectively a kind of very sophisticated form of barter. But they don't have coins. They don't have anything like that. And so gold for them, it is, you know, it's prized, it's nice, but it's not a denominator of some other form of value, which is obviously why they're so keen to give it to the Spaniards. You know, it's, they're giving them something shiny and nice, and, but they're not giving them something that it is incredibly painful for them to give up, because that would get them something else. You know, that would denote economic status and all those, all that sort of stuff. The Aztecs aren't the only people with gold, of course. So, Tom, you and I have talked recently about the quest for El Dorado, haven't we? We were talking about that only the other day.
Only the other day.
And there were people in what's now Colombia called the Muisca, who were brilliant kind of goldsmiths, gold metal workers. You know, the Spaniards were very excited when they got to what's now Bogota by their gold. But again, gold was not valued in the same way that Europeans valued it. I mean, Europeans value gold as a means to an end. Gold will buy them estates, buy status.
Is it true that Quetzal feathers were more valued than gold?
Yes, I think it is true. Featherwork, people often, so Matthew Restall, who we talked about a lot, writes a bit about featherwork in one of his books, I can't remember which it is, about how highly the artistic work with feathers is prized. And exactly that, the Quetzal feathers, these very brightly colored feathers, were regarded as signs of status and of beauty in a way that probably gold perhaps wasn't.
Because the, I mean, this is something that goes right the way up to the 18th century, Hawaii, when Captain Cook lands,
yeah,
and he meets with chiefs who are wearing cloaks made of feathers taken from the birds in Hawaii. It's not just that it's beautiful, but the effort of labor to weave together so many, because of course the feathers in of birds in Hawaii are often very small. Effort required is stupefying, and that would be a symbol of status, but it would also be an object of wealth beyond the dreams of anyone else.
That's a lovely comparison.
Thank you.
Damien has a question, which we talk about at the very end of the series, but I'm aware not everyone would have got that far. Had Spain not colonized Mexico and the rest of South America with Portugal, would France and England have done so? What would be different, if anything? So Tom, putting your kind of big history hat on, had England or France, rather than the Iberian nations, colonized more of the Americas, do you think they would be very different?
Well, I don't think they would have done, is the simple answer.
Okay.
Because I don't see how the English would have ended up colonizing, say, Brazil, when the Portuguese didn't, or the Spanish. You're dependent on the winds and on the currents, and that depend, you know, where you start will depend on where you end up.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's a kind of, it's an impossible question, because you're battling against all kinds of things.
I suppose, is there some scenario where Portugal and Spain, well, Spain doesn't exist? This is the classic thing we've often talked about with counterfactuals, that actually you start with a fairly simple question, but in order to explore it, you start getting deeper and deeper into the kind of, into the murky waters of your alternative universe.
I mean, the other question is, does England discover it before the Reformation?
That was what I was going to ask you.
That's quite a key determinant for the culture of right, the English settlements in the New World, as opposed to the Spanish settlements, is that the Spanish are Catholic and the English in the heyday of their settlement are very definitely Protestant.
Yeah, a Protestant Argentina looks very different from a Catholic one. However, I suppose what you could say is Brazil, for example, is becoming more and more Protestant, isn't it? It's now an absolute heartland of white, of sort of evangelical.
Becoming very Pentecostal. So I remember when I was finishing Dominion, I was very tempted to write about Pentecostalism, because the two great globe-changing trends in religion in the 21st century, one has been very, very much in the face of the news media, which is radical Islam, and the other has been absolutely below the radar, which is the spread of Pentecostalism.
Yeah.
Not just in Catholic South America, but across Africa, and particularly in Asia.
So Tom, for listeners who are not enthusiastic vicars and all these kinds of people. What is Pentecostalism? So it's speaking in tongues, all that stuff?
Yeah, so Pentecost is when the Holy Spirit descends on the apostles and they start to speak in tongues. Exactly so. They can go out into the streets and they can be understood.
Yeah.
And it's the idea that the Spirit descends and your soul is enlightened and then you speak in tongues and miracles are done. It combines with kind of quite a literalist understanding of the Bible, the fact that miracles are possible to be achieved in the present day. And it's a massive, massive movement. And it's gone under, certainly under the kind of the Western radar, I think, because it tends to be very educated people tend not to buy into it. And also because Pentecostalists tend not to go around blowing up underground trains or flying planes into skyscrapers.
Yeah.
And so they are less on the front pages of newspapers.
I think certainly in, well, certainly in Britain, and I guess in Western Europe, possibly parts of the United States, highly educated, sort of elite people regard it as vulgar. And they regard it, they identify it with sort of big tent meetings in the deep south of the United States or in the, you know, the sort of expanding West. Like that scene at the beginning of Blood Meridian.
Yes, the guy with the goat.
Yeah, exactly. So for that reason, we're conditioned to think it's kind of wacky. But the first time I really noticed it was after nice footballing reference, after Brazil won the 2002 World Cup and they beat Germany 2-0 in the final. And then some of their players took off their shirts and they're wearing vests with like, thank you, Jesus, and stuff written on it. People like Lucio, who was like a really kind of big, burly defender. And it seemed so implausible and sort of bizarre in a way to British viewers. I can remember the people I was watching with thinking, God, that's weird. But of course, the footballers who are very rich, but are from working class backgrounds in Brazil, often from the favelas, they're absolutely typical of the kind of people who have been drawn to this massively growing Pentecostal movement in Brazil.
I think lots of people are simply not even aware of it. So I wasn't particularly aware that there was a Pentecostalist church, for instance, on Brixton Hill, just up the road from where I live. And I discovered that there was this ruach, the breath of the Holy Spirit. And I went there and it was like a nightclub without any music. People were just moving, dancing, swaying, sweat dripping off the ceilings. And I have never felt more middle class than English. I stood there in kind of frozen embarrassment.
It won't astonish you to know that a Sambrook attendance at a Pentecostal church is a very, very unlikely.
Yes.
I mean, I don't really like nightclubs where they do have music, so. Okay, Theo wants to move on. He's gesturing impatiently.
So here's a question from Arena. Which woman from history would you choose to make a movie about?
Well, Zendaya is lined up apparently to play Cleopatra. So against my wishes, Denis Villeneuve, who did Blade Runner and Dune, apparently is considering making a Cleopatra film, and he is not proposing to cast Tom Holland.
As Anthony?
No, it's Octavian, which is what I think he should do. Mm. He's apparently going to cast Timothy Chalamet as Octavian. This is according to rumors, so it may not happen. So I think Cleopatra is obviously a brilliant topic. I mean, actually, Malinche, who we've talked about loads in the Aztec series, there is a TV series, I think, called Malinche. There have been multiple ones, but none of them terribly good. I think Malinche would be brilliant. Don't you?
Yeah, she'd be great.
Who would you choose?
I would obviously choose Æthelflæd.
Æthelflæd.
Lady of the Mercians.
It's been done. It's The Last Kingdom. She's in The Last Kingdom.
Yeah, but, well, I haven't seen that.
Have you not seen The Last Kingdom, Tom?
I find the modern perspective incredibly annoying.
Ah, but they've got the Battle of Tettenhall. They've got all that stuff that you love. Yeah.
Well, whatever. Okay. Well, but that's a TV series.
Yeah.
It's not a
movie. What was she asking about? A film?
Yeah.
The lines are very blurred these days, to be fair. I mean, that Napoleon thing is going to be streaming as well as in cinema. So I think we can bend Arena's question.
Well, I mean, it's not like they haven't made films about Cleopatra.
No, but I think they can make more.
Right. So they can make more films about Æthelflæd.
Okay. This is one for you because it's a phrase you love. It's from Claire H. Like many non-British wangs, I struggle to define massive lad with any precision. And I'm hoping that a ranking of historical figures might help. Which are the most significant massive lads in history? And before you answer that, I will just say that we're here with Theo, our producer, and Dom, our erstwhile producer. We welcome him back to The Rest Is History from the backwater of The Rest Is Politics, because they're with us in New Zealand. And we were talking the other day in the car and we agreed, I think it was generally agreed, that the single best thing, Tom, that you do in this podcast is your massive lad, public schoolboy sort of laugh and voice.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying you have to do it now.
And I'm not going to.
You're not a performing monkey.
No.
But I just want to commend you for it. because I think it's something that you really bring to the podcast that nobody else could bring.
In the context of the relationship of Massive Lads to the rest of history, as I recall, the first time that that voice and that phrase was unleashed was when we talked about Henry VIII's wives. And it was it Henry VIII and Charles Brandon, the Earl of Suffolk, dressing up as Robin Hood or something to go and meet Catherine of Aragon?
That's right. But to meet Anne of Cleves.
Anne of Cleves, that's right.
But, so that was the first use of the voice. No question. The gilet voice, as I think of it. But so, it wasn't the first use of the phrase, because the phrase was actually first used by your brother to describe Neville Chamberlain.
I'd forgotten that. Okay. So I would say Neville Chamberlain is not a massive lad.
No.
Neville Chamberlain wears tight collars, a furled umbrella, very thin, is absolutely not a massive lad. Charles Brandon is, I imagine him as being stocky, wears a rugby shirt, black shoes, jeans, chinos perhaps, goes skiing, has a sports car, has a girlfriend called Minty, has loads of friends.
I'm straying into it. Yeah. Loves a laugh.
Yeah. Basically, he's the best man. He's a very posh person's best man.
Yeah.
You'd want a massive lad as your best man. And that's what Charles Brandon was.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a roisterer.
A roisterer, a doisterer, a rugby player.
Yeah.
A beer drinker.
You know what it is, actually? It's an English public school educated person wearing an Irish rugby shirt.
No, I think you can wear your white rugby shirt, your white English rugby shirt. I mean, I agree, there's an absolute trend among the English upper class who support rugby.
Yeah.
They're born in Hampshire and they've been to some private school. Yeah, I love Ireland. I'm so Irish.
Yeah.
Or Scottish, whatever.
Theo Young Smith.
So I'm not mentioning any names.
Yeah. We've had a massive conversation, by the way, in New Zealand about this issue of chinos. You mentioned the chinos. There's bans on wearing chinos. This was our American listeners, because they love chinos.
They do love chinos, but I don't think it has quite the class connotations there, does it?
No, because some students are banned now from wearing chinos in student union buildings on the grounds that means they must be members of rugby. There must be massive lads, actually, ironically. They must be Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk. Right, Theo wants us to move on again.
So here's Isgithen. We've heard Boris Johnson doesn't have the skill set for a pandemic. Which PM, or indeed which leader generally, did or would have done? I mean, we can, the whole range of history.
Golly, my obvious answer to that is Margaret Thatcher, because she's the first scientist prime minister and sort of did respect experts' opinion and stuff. Although, of course, the difficulty is which expert you listen to. A skill set for a pandemic. You want to be reassuring, don't you? But you also want to be quite data-driven.
I mean, I'll tell you who didn't have the skill set for a pandemic.
Boris Johnson.
Edward III. Do you remember his approach to the Black Death?
No.
Black Death comes. I mean, much worse pandemic than COVID, obviously.
Yeah.
Maybe half the population of England get wiped out. And his advisors come and say, you should really be socially distancing. You know, it's a bit dangerous for you. And his response to this is to throw a massive party. St. George's Day tournament. Invites everyone from across Europe, and it's the largest tournament ever held in England.
That's his Novak Djokovic. That's what Djokovic did, isn't it? In Split, organised a big tennis tournament. They all got COVID.
Well, so Edward III, I'd say, but that's not the answer, is it?
No.
Who wouldn't? Is there?
I said Thatcher.
Yeah, Thatcher. I'd go for Thatcher. Yeah.
Yeah, I think she would have done well in a pandemic, actually.
So this is from Simon Girdleston. A question for you, Dominic. Which has been the most talented British cabinet since 1900?
Well, I know James, our community manager, will be pleased to hear me say Asquith's, because he's a massive Asquith fan.
He does love Asquith.
He loves Asquith.
He's so pleased that Asquith may shortly be appearing on a tote bag.
He said to me, James, our community manager, who I hope will listen to this, he said to me he was really disappointed with the top 10 prime ministers because he thought Asquith was too low. He thought Asquith was top five, absolutely top five.
Possibly top three.
So the Asquith cabinet has Churchill in it and Richard Haldane and Edward Grey and Lloyd George. That's a very talented cabinet. The Attlee cabinet has got some massive hitters.
Giants.
Yes. And Iron Bevan, Ernest Bevin, Stafford Cripps, Hugh Dalton. Now, people often say the Wilson cabinet, because that has, I mean, to us seem like massive beasts. Kind of Roy Jenkins, Dennis Healy, Crossman, Crossland. The trouble is those governments were kind of rubbish.
So here's a question.
Yeah.
Does the giant stature of the earlier cabinets reflect Britain's much greater geopolitical status, so that what they do seems to resonate and matter. Whereas by the time you get to the 60s, it don't matter much. And now they all seem like pygmies.
Yeah, basically, yes. I think two things. One, it seems to matter much more because, as you say, they're running an empire. They feel like imperial proconsuls or something. They're titanic figures. Two, the attitude that people have to politics has changed massively. So you could easily tell a story about Asquith's cabinet, let's say, that pains me, and it will pain James to hear this. And you could say Asquith, a man who displays a lot of poor form, I think it's fair to say, Tom.
Yeah.
Writing to his daughter's friend, mad crushes on girls. Yeah. Lloyd George, an absolute terror of a man.
A goat.
The goat.
But, yeah. I mean, kind of a goat in both senses of the word, perhaps.
If you're... Well... No, James has no time for Lloyd George. He's a Asquith man all the way. Anyway, you could sort of say, if these people were alive now, they would be absolute laughing stocks. We'd regard them as...
I mean, Asquith would yeah, he really would. He'd be in all the tabloids.
And Lloyd George. Lloyd George would be on I'm Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. No question. Mm. He would be like, what's that fellow? Hancock, Matt Hancock. They'd be regarded at that level. So maybe it's sort of a structural issue that our attitude to politics and our relationship with politicians has changed. Having said that, I still think, even though people complain that politicians have got worse, it doesn't mean they haven't got worse, and clearly they have got worse. The pay, for example, is now much less. The status is much lower. So frankly, Westminster attracts a different kind of people than it would have done perhaps in the Edwardian period. So yeah, I think there is an element of us thinking, you know, Churchill, we talked about this in our Churchill episodes. When Churchill started in Parliament, he said, well, of course, when I started in Parliament, it wasn't as good as when I was a boy. The great giants were gone and all that sort of thing. So, but I do think there was a sort of period between, I don't know, 1870 and 1960, when by and large, the standard, the top end was far higher than it is today. And the cabinets were generally made of generally pretty serious, highly educated, thoughtful, generally hardworking people. Now, are people going to say that in the future about Grant Shapps?
Or David Cameron, who's just been brought back. Well,
David Cameron, my neighbour, is back in. Secretary. Very exciting news. Good news for West Oxfordshire.
Yes, Dave is very proud. He's a cross old man.
Dave is
no
back
longer. He's no longer hanging around the Waitrose and chipping Norton.
It's M&S, actually. It's M&S, where I see him being harangued by women at the checkouts about Brexit. So he's put that behind him now. So, Tom, on that bombshell, let's just quickly talk about what's coming ahead. We're finishing off the Aztecs eventually. Is there something before JFK? Yes, there's a one-off before JFK.
Oh, yes, on Windrush.
On the Windrush. So for those people who don't know, the Empire Windrush is the ship that arrives in Britain in the aftermath of the Second World War, carrying immigrants from the Caribbean, and it has become an iconic moment, Tom.
20th century British history.
20th century British history. So,
but I think the ramifications of it are of interest to all Western countries that have opened their borders.
Exactly.
So it's not just a British story.
We have a guest coming on called Trevor Phillips, who's a very distinguished figure in the history of British race relations, but also co-wrote with his brother Mike, and one of the first histories, I think the first history, of the Windrush generation. So these people who came over in the 1940s and 1950s and started new lives in Britain, and whose children, of course, grew up as British. So we're doing that, and then we are into another mighty series, and this is John F. Kennedy, the life and death, and the subsequent exciting series.
So listeners may have appreciated the fact that there is a growing kind of episode inflation going on, and what happens is that Dominic prints off his notes, and he says, oh, this will take maybe 4 episodes. It takes 8, as with the Aztecs. And how many did you think it was going to be for Kennedy?
3,
and it's 7. So, yeah,
so double it.
First episode is Kennedy up to his presidency. Second is his presidency. Then 3rd, 4th, and 5th is a very, very deep dive into the events of the day of the assassination and the 3 days that follow it. And then the 6th episode, we look at the various theories as to who might have been behind the Kennedy assassination. And then the 7th, we look at the life and character of Lee Harvey Oswald. So we hope you enjoy them. I think they're great.
Oh. I
really great. And then after that, what have we got? We've got my brother talking about the war in Italy in 1943. We've got Pope Joan, the supposed a woman who became Pope in the Middle Ages. And we've got Zadie Smith on the Tichborne Claimant, which is the maddest case in British legal history. So lots to look forward to. And if you were down under, you will be getting this...
upside down.
Upside down. Well, we're upside down, so... But you'll be getting this on the day that we appear in Auckland. And then we are going to Australia, and we're going to Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide, and Perth.
Yep.
So we're looking forward to that very, very much.
And on that bombshell, Theo making the cutting gesture at his neck. So on that bombshell, we will say goodbye.
Goodbye.